Can you upload
this
freely?
Yes, I will.
Thanks.
That's tremendous. That's tremendous.
It's actually recorded.
Pardon?
There's no tape.
You are listening to Amit Dalai. There you go. All
right. Help, I'm trapped in your speaker.
No,
help.
I'm waiting till, like, you know, the guy just has to come over to you and go, you know, and then the tape recorder starts and when you're there, you know, like this.
All right. Okay, so I've been asked to give a short introduction for Vinny. He's actually a neighbor of ours who lives about a 10-minute walk from here. Maybe I shouldn't say that after
you hear
this.
Which is my greatest and only claim to fame.
So I'm sure everyone's going to want to go knock on his door and ask him more questions.
No, for those of you who haven't taken your smicha bechina yet, we have an inn. Anyone who moves to a front gets a discount now. Cover your bechina and still done. So. No laughter there. Okay, I guess you guys are nervous about Bechinas.
Starts tomorrow.
It doesn't matter. Listen, I have some bad news for you, I have to tell you. It's been now, I don't know, 15 years, and in all those 15 years, no one has ever asked me where I got smicha. Ever. And they've never... they never asked me a shayla in Hilchos Malicha, Hilchos Nida, Hilchos Shchita, Hilchos... I think I got one bus of a chalav once. Discussion for the end of this topic, if it interests you as to why and what my opinion on that matter is, and how much better I could have used those 3-4 years. But anyway, go ahead. Am I inspiring you? Yes, it's good. Yeah.
We're all leaving.
See, the trick is how to make sure you never get invited back, because it saves you a lot of time. You know. Okay.
So the accolades of Rav Vinny are many. He got smicha here at the Gush. Spent many, many years learning there under Rev Lichtenstein. He also was and I think still is, in the Israeli army, is a commander in the Israeli army. He's a very, very well-known worldwide educator at the Israelite Institute. We heard Rabbi Aaron today speak from there. He's also a wonderful tour guide. If you haven't seen Masada with Rav Vinny, you haven't seen Masada, you haven't lived Masada. It's one of my favorites. And now he's starting this coming year. He's going to be the Rosh Yeshiva of a new post-high school yeshiva called Oraita. Mm-hmm. Right? All right.
That's good.
Not bad. And one of my feelings about Rav Vinny is that not only is he someone who has learned for a tremendous amount of time, but he's also really embodied these texts. He is someone that, through just being with him, really inspires people to be better, to want to come closer to God, to want to come closer to Judaism. I know this because Rav Vinny was one of the very first teachers that I had when I came to Israel and started to experience religious Judaism for the first time. So, halavai, every Jew should meet Rav Vinny to be exposed to what a religious Jew is. It's a real treat to have him here. So, thank you very much, Rav Vinny.
Well done. We're going to tape that. Next time we're just
going to
play
it.
It's on tape. It's there. All right. All right. So some of you have met, some of you have met a few times, some of you we haven't met. It's a pleasure to be here, and I also want to especially thank Leo D, who is heading off Harav Hagon. Leo D, who is heading off to England with the brave goal of attempting to infuse a joy into the English countryside. It's a big challenge. They've got the top hat waiting for him. The reason that we're sitting here today is because some people just refuse to give up, and that, I guess, is the most important lesson educationally, is if you go out there, whenever you go out there, and you're convinced that something is worthwhile, so just because people say no, just because they beg off, don't let them go. Do whatever it is you feel you need to do. We wish you tremendous aslacha, and this is an interesting topic on a number of different levels. We spend an enormous amount of time trying to get there, okay? And we spend so much time trying to get there that we very often don't realize where we already are. You know, you could make a case for saying that this is the essence of Shabbat, right? That all week long, I think Arya Kaplan in one of his Sfarim discusses this, that all week long we are human becomings. We're attempting to grow, to change. And Dafka and Shabbat, we're supposed to try to be human beings. We're supposed to be in the world of being. Just imagining where we are, trying to figure out what was accomplished during the week, where we could go, why we're here, what we're meant to do with it. And on a certain level, as educators, especially for those of you who really choose, and I hope if you're spending a few years here learning and getting your smicha, that you intend to go into this field. Otherwise, there's a lot of other things you could be learning. If you do go into this field, and if you're not thinking about going into this field, then come talk to me, because I'll try to convince you that you should. And if I don't try to convince you you should, then you should wonder about other things. But I think that this happens to us most of all. You know, we are so busy becoming that we don't stop for our own being. And very often we're into the becomings of everybody else. And unless we figure out how to tap into where we're at and our own process of being, it affects our ability not only in our own personal becoming, but in making a difference in everybody else's. Right? I found when I guess, started to get into this, it's hard to call it work because it's too much fun, but Rabbanut, Kiruv, outreach, whatever word you think works that we've already discussed doesn't work. There are certain things that you just don't have time for. One of them, by the way, is learning. I thought, you know, rabbis probably have the most time to learn. Rabbis have the least time to learn. Unless you're teaching in yeshiva, right? That's why I'm trying to start yeshiva next year, so I have plenty of time to learn. But the challenge is how to make that time, how to find that balance. And part of the question that inevitably has to be raised in that context is the question of shlemut, right? What is shlemut? How do we arrive at shlemut? How do you even define shlemut? Wholeness? Completeness? Do you have to know where it is you're going in order to define what completion is, right? Is there such a thing as attainable shlemut? Right? One could make a case for saying that shlemut doesn't exist in this world. It's not meant to. It certainly doesn't exist for us. That may well be why one of the names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Shalom, and why halachically one has a problem saying Shalom in the bathroom, because that's one of the names of Hashem. Bearing that in mind, there are certain instances when one encounters people who have achieved a certain degree of shlemut. And you have to stand in awe of that type of shlemut. And sometimes it comes in the most unexpected packages. I'll give you an example. On Friday night, so you finish Kabbalat Shabbat, right? And hopefully you had a meaningful Kabbalat Shabbat. And if a miftar has grown since I was teaching here, maybe you even stuck some kalbach into Kabbalat Shabbat. And you're flying, right? And then you get the ma'ariv. And for whatever the reason, you know, Tefillat Arvit, Ma'ariv is kind of like, oh, we don't have to sing anymore. We did the singing. Now we're just gonna coast. We're gonna zip through Ma'ariv because we have to get to dinner, right? And so the funny thing is that the Kabbalat Shabbat, which is not halachically a tefillah, you don't need a mechitza. Right? By the way, nothing we say in the context of these discussions should remotely be presumed to be anything resembling psak. Did I make that clear enough, okay? I'm not a posig, I don't want to be a posig. You're an yeshiva, you have Rosh Yeshiva, you have Rebbeim. So if something I say challenges your perception, don't assume that I'm giving you some halachic background. Go and argue with your Rebbeim, okay? But Kabbalat Shabbat is not really a tefillah. In fact, you don't need a mechitza for Kabbalat Shabbat. You don't even need a minyan for Kabbalat Shabbat. In fact, when we used to run in Boca Raton, the Kalbach Minyan, Rabbi Brander, who you may have met, I don't know, today runs the Center of the Jewish Future in Yeshiva University, which is an Irgun, an organization that's worth getting to know if you plan to enter this field. So when I got to Boca, they had this miserable Kalbach Minyan that was all the way in the back of the show. They would get, you know, and I was excited when I heard there's a Kalbach Minyan there, and I don't go to Kalbach every week, because I just think if you go to Kalbach every week, you basically take the variety and the excitement of the Kalbach Minyan as Shlomo Kalbach envisioned it, and you turn it into your new routine, right? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. But, you know, once in a while, I take the kids, go, get that little oomph, right? And it was depressing. You know, I got there for Mincha. It took about a half an hour to live by Shura for Mincha. Then Mincha was Kalbach, so you have to daven Mincha like Kalbach. So that took another half an hour, 40 minutes. And then by the time we got to Kabbalat Shabbat, the guests were already waiting, and by the time we finished Kabbalat Shabbat, so, you know, my wife basically said, like, we're not doing this again, right? You know, I love you and it's beautiful and sing all you want, but do it after dinner, right? So about 2 months after that pleasant experience, Rabbi Brander, you know, came over to me one day and said, look, you know, we're trying to get the Kalbach Minyan rolling and there are people who really want to have it and it's important. Would you be willing to take it over? So I said to him, you know, I'm willing to do the Kalbach Minyan. I actually enjoy Kalbach, but there's a few conditions. First thing is, we have to all daven mincha together. You can't have Kalbach people starting a mincha minyan, because it'll never happen, right? It just doesn't work that way. And that's not what they want to be doing anyway. They want to get the Kabbalat Shabbat. So what we would do is we would daven mincha in the main shul, right? And then at the end of mincha, right, which of course meant that everybody got there in time, and at the end of mincha they would announce that the Kalbach minyan is starting right now in the ballroom. We also had them move it up to the front. And the second deal was, like, I would daven Kabbalat Shabbat every week until we got the routine set, right? So I would go into the ballroom, especially at the beginning. We would just finish mincha. I would run in there, put on a talis. It'd be me and one other guy. And I'd start davening Kabbalat Shabbat. And we'd have four, five, six guys. And by the time we got to the second mizmor, third mizmor, people were walking in. So then we had a bigger group. And the goal was, could you create a Kalbach minyan that actually finished on time? Right? Which I think we succeeded in doing. And so by the end, we had 100 people coming every Shabbos. But that was the deal. Didn't matter to me. Right? So in between Kabbalat Shabbat, which is not really a minyan, which is all about like Kabel, right? There's no Kabbalat Yom Kippur, there's no Kabbalat Rosh Hashanah, only Kabbalat Shabbat, because Shabbat is all about Lekabel, right? And before we get to Marav, so we do this strange thing. Now, I'm not talking about the Sephardim, who in this case, I think, get it right. They do Kegavna, which, whatever, that's another discussion. What do? We learn by Memad Likin. So there are all sorts of different bases as to how we started saying Dafka by Memad Likin, and why it is that people say it instead of learning it, and what the purpose of learning in between these two moments is, and the fact that you get the chance to say Kaddish Rabbanan. The question arises, why did they choose B'mei Madlikin? So if you think about it, right, the essence of the beginning, at least, of B'mei Madlikin is that it's not enough that you want to have the candle. The question becomes, what is the wick that you use? And that's what Shabbat is all about. Because all week long I'm trying to light a fire, I'm trying to bring light to the world, but on Shabbat, I have a chance to take a step back and ask myself, so the wick that is me, what sort of light is that producing, and am I happy with that wick? And sometimes, you look at the world, and you see that the most unexpected wicks, those that would seem to be the most polluted, produce the most beautiful light. And I'll give you a quick example, before we get into a different topic, which you will see relates to this topic, okay? Because this is essentially the question. This is the question, is how do we get to appreciate the different wicks that are in our menorot, whatever they'll be, and whoever and wherever you go, and how do we affect change? So I was once, it's hard to find which story you told and which story you didn't tell, so if I told this story, you know, and you heard it before, tough. We were in, but I don't think I heard this one. So we were in Lebanon. I came to Israel, by the way, in Tafshin Mem Aleph, 1981. I went to Gush, fell in love with the country, decided to stay Shanabet. Ended up going into the army, and I was in the army for a few years before I went back to Gush for everything else, Micha, and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, so it was about, I don't know, 2-3 months I was already a Katzin, and we were in Lebanon. And we were set to do a Ma'arav, right? So some of you have done the army, so if you haven't, the Ma'arav basically is an opportunity for intense, powerful boredom for an entire evening. Basically what you do is you sit on top of some godforsaken hill that some combat somewhere, some, you know, operations officer has chosen, and they use the same hill night after night for a month, you know, wondering afterwards why the terrorists might find out about it. And you have to lie there. There's some sort of intelligence information that terrorists might try to come through this particular valley. And you basically lie on this hill. In this case, it's called the Ma'arav Kochav. 8 guys lying in a circle with their feet in the inside and their heads outside. And, you know, everybody has a different quadrant, and they're all sort of, you know, double quadranted so that every area to look at is covered by 2 guys. And that's what you do. You sit there all night, usually from around 10 o'clock at night till like 6 in the morning, and you just watch and listen and report in every hour quietly, and if nobody comes through, then you go home, right? It is an intensely depressing, boring experience. By about the second hour, your neck starts to hurt. By about the fourth hour, it's on fire. You get back pains. You try to squiggle. You try to move. What happens if you have to go to the bathroom? How do you sneak off the hill to get some coffee and whatnot? So anyway, so we're on the way to this Ma'arav, and I was particularly depressed. Because for all of these, I don't know, wasn't that long, a couple months, 2-3 months, and counting Yitziyot, number of Shabbatot that I'd been in, I had managed to arrange it that I was never actually on patrol when Shabbat came in, right? Sometimes I would do an extra shift, sometimes I would, you know, take the tougher, you know, missions even on Shabbat, but Friday afternoon I wanted to know that I had that, like, hour before Shabbat to get ready, grab a shower, do my own Kabbalat Shabbat. I was the only guy with a kippah, maybe one other guy in the unit. We were in a mutzav somewhere in a position. This particular Friday, because of various things that happened, we got ambushed and all the routine got messed up. So, you know, they announced that the Ma'arav had to go out. And we were already out in the field. And instead of going back to base, we ended up going to where we were supposed to be going. And so it's about 10 o'clock at night. And, or 9 o'clock, I don't remember. And we're heading out for this Marav. Now, you don't just, you know, drive your jeeps up to this hill, right? Because, you know, and then everybody sees you. You have to sort of be dropped, like, you know, 5, 10 kilometers away. And you walk, you know, in the middle of the night. You do, like, a hike in a roundabout fashion to get to this position, right? And so I'm hiking, and it's, you know, Shabbat is, you know, sort of coming in, and there's nothing I can do about it, you know? And, you know, you can't exactly sing yourself a Lecha Dodi, as much as you think that's the great, like, at least I'll sing Kavanah Shabbat with the guys. You're walking in the middle of Lebanon, and you're responsible for an 8-man patrol walking through enemy territory. You can't exactly, you know, Lecha Dodi. Oh, you know, it doesn't work that way, right? So basically, I was getting more and more depressed, because I realized, like, I'm just not going to do anything. You know, like, maybe I'll be able to daven Ma'ariv silently lying on the ground. Depressing. No, we hadn't had food yet. They were going to get it to us. Forget about Kabbalat Shabbat and Ma'ariv and everything else. Just really depressing. And it was especially depressing because I was apparently the first, you know, today there are lots of Ktsinim or Dati, but back then this was a rarity, I guess. And so when the Magad, when the battalion commander saw that he had a Memem, a lieutenant, who had a kippah on his head, so he got all excited. And the first Shabbat that I was an officer in this base, he basically stopped everything, and everybody waited, and I walked in like 2 minutes late, and he started yelling at me, you know, like, Makarabah Frid Manu, Talbitz Kiddush, right? So the whole dining room would wait, and I would make Kiddush, and by the third time I was there for Shabbat, I got to sneak in a little Dvar Torah, you know, and I loved this. Like, this was like, that's why you're in the Israeli army, right? There's a Kiddush Hashem, was great. So I was also depressed, because I knew none of the guys would get Kiddush. They always make fun of me, make Kiddush, you know, Sheket Dvar Torah Shel Bini, right? So we're on the ground in the mud, and about, I don't know, a kilometer or two away from this hill, you stop, and there's a whole routine. You have to put on your, like, what's it called, chermonite, like a one-piece snowsuit, and you don't, because it's, you know, winter, and you don't put this on when you're hiking, because then you sweat, and then you lie on the ground, and you get, you know, hypothermia or whatever. So you switch, and while you're getting all your gear and doing last inspections, there's a whole routine of all the last-minute things you have to do. You check with the battalion, you know, you go on silent, everybody makes sure that they're quiet gear, whatever. And you send a couple guys ahead to the position to recon it, to make sure that there are no booby traps and everything. So all this is going on, and this was actually the point that I would get the most nervous. Because there was a lot of different details that you had to pay attention to, and I wasn't like an experienced officer, so I was sure like I would forget something, and I was nervous. And there was this sergeant whose name was Biton, and he was like, I don't know how to say this nicely, he was like in my mind the Antichrist. I just don't know any other way to look at him. He was the antithesis of everything I was trying to do in the dude, because he was... I mean, he was the only guy who had a tattoo, okay? And it was a tattoo that, let's say if one day he becomes a Balchuva, he's going to have to wear sleeves, because it's, like, you know, not my thing for a base manager. And, you know, he would come back from Yitziyot, and he would have, like, a couple earrings, now tell him it's not regulation. Like, that's this kind of guy. He's the guy who found a lamb and shechted it and had a big, you know, mangal with tray food. Like, that's who this guy was. So, but he was also first sergeant, and he was a good guy, and he was very veteran in the unit, and I would always kind of, like, you know, sort of be aware that he was watching me. Because he'd been in Lebanon, like, this was like his third tour, he'd been there like a year and a half. So we're lying on the ground, and I'm doing all these inspections, and I'm sure that I got it all, I think so, you know, I got the right frequency, checked everybody knows the passwords, and everybody has Mispari Barzel, and everybody's gear is checked, and they all have Machsanyot, and we called in the battalion, and they have the, you know, they know where we're up to, whatever. And the two guys come back, and we wait for them to get up on the gear, and then I'm ready to give the, you know, the pkuda, okay? And now you have to go, like, really silently, I say, you know, okay, kadima. And Biton, right, looks at me and goes, Galcha, what's the matter with you? So I look at him like, oh God, what did I forget? Gonna, you know, and it's not just if you forgot something, but then they're going to rag you on it all week, you know? Friedman, shechachta takesha, you know, something, right? So he's crawling over to me, because we're like, you know, lying on the ground. And he goes, Friedman, ma galcha, Shabbat. So I'm like, okay, that's not on the list. I don't get this one. He says, lo zazim bli kiddush. That's what he says to me. And he's got a canteen with something very non-regulation in it. and he says, Lo zazim bli kiddush. And all the guys are listening, they're all smiling, whatever. So at this point, now halachically, you know, do you make kiddush? You have a daven, you know. But if you get a biton, and he crawls over to you in the middle of Lebanon with a canteen full of God knows what, and says, let's make kiddush. So you throw halacha out of the window and you make kiddush. And I want you to know, it was absolutely the most meaningful kiddush I ever had. And that is a wick that you would not normally think you could light a menorah with. And yet that wick ends up producing the purest light of the evening. That is a form of shlemut. Now how do you get there, and where does it meet? So bear that in mind, though I'm not quite sure we'll get back to that. And I want to share a piece with you. Okay? You got these photos that or whatever, okay? We have a tremendous challenge. And I got to give you a little bit of introduction, just so we're all on the same page. Some of us have had this discussion intensely before, and some of us have never discussed it. So even though this itself is a topic for like a long shiur, at least let's take 10 minutes and just be sure we're on the same page. As much as it's true that we spend an enormous amount of time trying to get there, and therefore we don't appreciate where we are, there are all sorts of vehicles that we have in Judaism, okay, to get there, that we don't stop to appreciate, right? And if I had to pick the one that's most obvious, okay, in other words, you know, the kid from Yeshiva High School who is given this something on a silver platter, but never gets the chance to explore what it is, and therefore can't be blamed for not realizing how valuable it is, it would probably be tefillah. Okay? We went, Rav Yonatan mentioned before that we're starting a yeshiva mitzvah this fall. It's an interesting discussion for another time, but basically this is geared to guys who are mostly post-yeshiva high school, right? Although we have a couple of NCSY-inspired kids, and they have been through the loop, right? They know what Gemara is, they know what Tanakh is, many of them know Hebrew, they all know how to read Hebrew, they recognize the Aleph Beis. Many of them are very smart, and it's precisely because they're smart and they have such good questions, right, that their Rebbeim don't seem to be able to answer their questions. So they're usually one foot out the door. In other words, the Judaism that they've been sold doesn't make sense to them. And by the way, they're right, right? That Judaism doesn't make sense. I happen to think that's not really what Judaism is, which is another topic. And the question is, can you, within the context of our core values, you know, within the framework of halacha on the one hand, and yet an open-minded, non-coercive, non-confrontational experience, can you share with these boys a Judaism that's meaningful, that's full of joy and full of love, etc., right? So during the course of the process of getting these guys to come to this yeshiva, in Baruch Hashem we have 20 guys, an amazing group of guys coming, I ended up traveling the States and Canada this year and becoming exposed to the Jewish yeshiva high school experience in America, and I have to tell you, it was a shocking experience. Some of you are much more aware of this than I was. It's a shocking experience. And there are many questions that arise and many issues that have come to the fore for me that I'm still grappling with. But it was interesting to me to realize that the more you meet kids who are struggling with this, not the kid who grew up without anything, whatever that would mean, and sort of came to a curiosity to search for what Judaism really is all about, but the kid who's been given Judaism from the time he was born and has decided at a certain point, based on his struggles, to let it go, inevitably, if you had to find the point at which that student began to demonstrate overtly that there was an issue, it was almost always in tefillah. And as you show me a kid who davens with kavana, and I'll show you a kid who's not at risk. And I'm not talking about risk in terms of like, you know, rebellion that takes all sorts of unhealthy forms, you know, chemical substances. I'm talking about just at risk in terms of a kid who goes off to university of whatever, Arizona, Stanford, Pennsylvania, and he's a good kid. He's never been in trouble. He doesn't drink. He doesn't do drugs. Doesn't do anything like that. But he has no idea why he should be Jewish. He has no idea what it means to have a relationship with God, let alone whether Hashem exists, let alone whether Hashem is involved with his life. He doesn't really understand why we're meant to do all these mitzvot, and he certainly doesn't love learning Gemara. But he's just come out of 12 years, the last 4, 5, or 6 of which have been intensely devoted to learning Gemara, but nobody can ever explain to him why it is that he learns Gemara. Right? And this is an intense problem. If you could pinpoint the point at which that struggle begins, it's almost always in tefillah. And that makes tefillah a very important issue. Okay? So before we get into a particular tefillah, in which I think Rav Cook sort of takes apart this question to some degree, we need to have an overview of tefillah for 10 minutes, just because some of us this will be chazara, and some of us maybe it'll be a new idea, but if you have this 10 minutes that we're about to talk about under your belt, right, so to speak, then yours is the earth. And it almost doesn't matter what we do afterwards, because if you can't respond and immerse yourself in this topic, if you don't have the ability to communicate this idea, then my personal opinion, which could be wrong, is that you're missing something very serious in terms of your ability to communicate, our ability to communicate what Judaism is all about, and in this particular case, what tefillah is all about. So the first question becomes, before we get to this particular tefillah, first question becomes, well, what is tefillah? Right? And you have to understand that people have major questions when it comes to tefillah, and those questions are very good questions. Right? First of all, imagine that, you know, some of you just daven mincha, and imagine that there's, I don't know, somebody you're thinking about. There's still patients from that terrible bulldozer rampage. They're lying in hospitals. So maybe you either know someone or you're thinking of them and you don't even know who they are, and you're asking Kodesh Baruch Hu, you know, v'rapeh et ha'chole, right? Pshat. You're asking Hashem to heal such and such a person, right? And this person is lying in a hospital bed. That's as pure a tefillah as you can get. Except, of course, that the yeshiva high school kid is in 12th grade and has a very good question. Why do you have to ask God to heal this person? That's ridiculous. Hashem already knows that this person needs to be healed. Hashem's already decided whether this person should be healed. Hashem already knows that you want this person to be healed. So the process of you going to David to ask Hashem lebriut, to ask Hashem that somebody be healed, is ridiculous. Right? And even if it made sense that you would somehow communicate to Hashem that you want this person to be healed, why do you have to do that in the context of a minyan? Why do you have to go to shul? What's the value of that? And why do you have to say it in the particular language that Chazal seemed to have given us? And all of these types of questions make tefillah a very challenging experience, right? So again, this is a 2 hours worth of discussion that we're going to condense into 8 minutes now, but bear with me. The first question is, and I want you to know, in my opinion, before we get to the Ashrei, this is an outline for what, after many years, at least to me, is the best approach to struggling with this question. So it's not just about the particular content, but about the order of these discussions. Before you can talk about what tefillah is, you have to talk about what tefillah is not. Now again, some of us have had this discussion, but just to remind you, tefillah is not prayer. Okay? The English word prayer is not a Jewish word. It's a Christian word. And if you look up in a dictionary, the word to pray, right? The word to pray is to entreat. To beg, like a praying mantis who begs. And prayer implies that I am nothing and God is everything, and that this is all about God, and that everything is in God's hands, and I throw myself before the mercy of the court. Putting aside the challenges for the moment with that approach, that's not at all what Judaism believes tefillah is about. The word tefillah is a completely different word, which is why we'll either say tefillah or davening, and not prayer, because prayer just isn't what it's about. So what is the word tefillah? So I'll give you two quick ideas. When Rachel names her surrogate son Naftali, okay, in Parshat Vayetze, I think. So she says, Naftulei Elokim Niftal. Right? So there are different translations to that. Shimshon Rafael Hirsch suggests that what that means is, I have struggled the struggles of God. Okay? I've struggled. Tefillah is about struggle. Okay? It's interesting to note that in Diktuk, there are 7 forms. Right? There's Paul, Piel, Puel, Hitpel, right? I can say, Yashavti, I sat down, that's the Paul. I can say, Hit Yashavti, I sat myself down, that's the Hitpel, the reflexive, something I do to myself. I could say, Lavashti Chutza, I wore a shirt, right? I could say, Hitlabashti Bechutza, I dressed myself in a shirt. That's the reflexive, Hitpel. So, we don't say Palalti. We say Hitpalalti. Because Tfilah is in the reflexive form. Tefillah is about something that I am trying to do to and for myself. It's not about what I do to God. You can't change God. Ani Hashem lo shineti. In fact, that's the essential question of tefillah. How can you change God's mind? You're not trying to change God's mind. Because Hashem is eternal and Hashem is ever-present and unchanging. Right? But we can change. Okay? So, lehit palel is to struggle to some degree with myself. Now, what does that mean? So Rav Kook, and it's important to understand Rav Kook's perspective because we're going to study a piece of Rav Kook. Rav Kook suggests in the Olat HaRiyah, which I'll get to in a second, in his introduction, that when Yaakov is on his deathbed and Yosef comes to see him, this is a very poignant moment, right? Because this is the end of Yaakov's life. According to the Medrash, this is the first instance that a person ever got sick. Now, whether you accept Medrash as literal or allegorical, which is a legitimate question among Divrei Chazal, and it's important, I guess, if we're going to communicate, for you to realize that I don't look at it literally. Not that things in the Midrash might not have happened. I'm sure many of them did. But I don't think that's the purpose of Midrash. And that's definitely what the Vilna Gaon believed, and it's definitely what the Rashbam believed, and it's definitely what the Ramchal and Datvuna believe, and so on and so forth. So I'm going to allow myself to take that opinion. The question is what the message of that Midrash is. I guess the way that I got clued into what might really be going on in that Midrash is actually from a most unlikely source. There's a fellow by the name of Zach Baumel. I hope you know his name. If you don't, shame on you, you should. He's an Israeli tank soldier who's been missing in action since 1982 in the Battle of Sultan Yaakov. And He was a close friend, is a close friend, I hope. And over the years, I became close with his family. And his father, Yonah Baumel, once told me that the most powerful pasuk for him in the entire Torah was when Yaakov is informed by his sons that Yosef is dead. Haker na, right? Recognize this ketonet, this coat that you gave to Yosef. So it says, regarding Yaakov's reaction, Vayimma ein lihitnecham. He is inconsolable. So first I'm going to talk about why he's inconsolable, and one possibility is because he has no closure. He never had the opportunity to say goodbye. And Yonah Baumel told me, that's me. I understand this pasuk better than most people will ever imagine this pasuk. All I want is closure. The ability to say goodbye. If he's dead, let me know that he's dead. And if he's alive, let me have him home. Right? Very difficult question. Very much in the news with everything that's going on right now. So, it's almost as though HaKadosh Baruch Hu recognizes that Yaakov was never given that goodbye. So now Hashem gives Yaakov that goodbye. Yosef comes to see Yaakov. Till then, according to the Medrash, people just dropped dead. They sneezed. Parcha nishmatam, right? When man is created, it says, Vayipach be'apav nishmat ruachayim. Right? Hashem created us by breathing into us life, whatever that means. So therefore, when we expire, that breath comes out. And so, on some level, again, allegorically, before Yaakov, people just dropped dead. You didn't know they were going to die. Just one day they're here, and one day they're not. Is that a klala? Is that a bracha? Good question. Now Yaakov is given the opportunity to say goodbye, and Yosef comes to see him. And Yaakov, in that moment, says an amazing thing. He says, this is in Perek Memchet, you can look it up, Ra'ofanecha lo pilauti. I never paleled that I would ever see your face. So Rashi says, what does it mean, palel? Right? Lo mil'ani libi lachshov. I didn't fill my heart with the possibility, right? With imagining that I would ever see you again, right? Because I thought you were dead. For 22 years, Yaakov thinks Yosef is dead. So he says to Yosef, I never imagined I would ever see you again. Now, on one level, that relates to the whole question of why Yosef didn't contact Yaakov and why Yaakov didn't contact Yosef, and there's some brilliant discussions about that topic, not for now. But on a deeper level, that root, suggests Rav Kook, is the root of tefillah. So that means that the word palel means to imagine, to dream, to wish. And lehit palel is to cause myself to imagine, to dream, to wish. Okay? Now, if that's true, what is it that I'm doing in tefillah? I'm struggling with what my dreams are. I'm struggling with what my wish is. Okay? The Anshei Knesset HaGdola, 120 men of the Great Assembly, the greatest, the most august body probably ever assembled, right? This body of individuals in the time of Ezra, at the beginning of Bayit Sheni, yeah, you're talking about 2,500 plus years ago, included Nevi'im, Mordechai of Purim fame, Daniel of the Lion's Den, right? Haggai, Tzfanya, Malachi, right? The least of them probably was Shimon HaTzadik, the only individual in the time of the Mishnah called Tzadik. And this totality of greatness got together and realized that the Jewish people had forgotten the Davin. That's what the Gemara says in Brachos. What does it mean they forgot the Davin? So if you translate that into the paradigm created by this definition, it means that they forgot the dream. They forgot what they could want. They forgot what they could imagine. Right? This is no less true today than it was then. You look around the Jewish world today, right? We've forgotten what we could want. The things that we want are ridiculous. So they create a list of the 18, 19 items that we should and could want. Okay? It can't be. And by the way, the process, the power of wanting is a very powerful idea. Rav Dessler suggests that nothing comes into the world unless somebody wants it. Wanting, ratzon, is the vehicle through which Hashem allows things to come into the world. Now, where ratzon comes from, where desire comes from, so that's a separate discussion. That's a mystery to some degree. Why is one child born with an artistic desire, and one child is born with a more literary desire? One person wants to be a journalist, another person wants to be a businessman. I was sitting with a boy yesterday, gifted boy from South Africa. He's going to HaKotel for his third year. He's in the process of gradually becoming a Talmud Chacham, which from that community is very rare. He's planning on going back there for college, and we had this whole discussion about the fact that if he's going back to South Africa, he has so much to give to the community, he should be struggling about whether he should go into chinuch. And he looked at me point blank, and he said, look, I'll be honest with you, I just don't want to do that. It's not about the money. I want to go into business because I think I can really do great things, and I think I can do good things in business and have an impact on the Jewish community. He's right. If that's where his netiyah is, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi agreed with him. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi went into business. Then the question is, while he's a businessman, what else he can do? That's a different discussion. That's a mystery, where our ratzon comes from. But the question is, what do we do with that ratzon? What do we do with that desire? If you're given a ratzon, if you have certain wants, certain desires, then you have to work them. Right? It's like a muscle. If you get into an accident and you break your arm, and then you finally get the cast off, you haven't used your muscle much. So it atrophies. So you have to do physical therapy and exercise it. Otherwise you lose the ability to fulfill the potential that that arm can give you. Well, the same is true with will. Right? Willpower is not just a throwaway term. Will is the fuel that allows us to do the things we want to do in this world, and we need to exercise that will. We need to struggle with that will. We need to think about that will. We need to motivate ourselves to that will, and that is the essence of tefillah. People walk out of shul and they say, did Hashem hear what I asked for? Did Hashem hear my tefillah? It's ridiculous. The question is not, did Hashem hear what you asked for? The question is, do you hear what you asked for? In fact, there's even a halacha that you're supposed to say tefillah out loud, even Shmona Esrei, but that's another discussion, because you're supposed to hear what you want, because that's really the question. Do I know what I want? Do I want what I want? Am I shalem with what I want? So that's the first idea with tefillah. Right? When I say Sim Shalom, it's not because I'm asking God for peace. It's because I'm struggling with whether I really want peace. And I'm recognizing that if I really want peace, if I really focus on how much I want peace, and how much better the world would be with peace, and if that allows me to become motivated to make a difference in the world to help to bring peace, then I become a better person. What changes through the process of tefillah is not HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What changes is me. And that occurs through the process of tefillah. So that's number one. Number two, and then we can get to the Ashrei, is an idea that also Rav Kook shares from his Hakdama, his introduction. He quotes a Gemara in Brachos, and this is a whole other discussion. It says, I think, on Daf Nun Gimel. Okay, it's easy to look up. Nun Gimel and Aleph, I think. Darash Rabbi Simlai, right? Rabbi Simlai taught, Leolam Yesader Adam Shivcho Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Achakech Yitpaleh. A person should always praise Hashem greatly, set up the praise, and then he should be mitpalel, he should daven, right? So the question is what that means. So Rabbi Simlai says, how do I know this? So he brings a proof text from no less than Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshat Va'etchanan has a clear ratzon, he has a clear desire, he wants desperately to enter Eretz Yisrael, right? And he's going to ask Hashem to enter Eretz Yisrael. But before he asks Hashem to enter Eretz Yisrael, right? Before he says, Ebrana vere, let me pass over and see at Eretz HaTova, Zev, Alvanon, etc. First he says, Hashem Miyal Kamocha, Bashamayim Varetz. First he praises Hashem. So since Moshe Rabbeinu praises Hashem first, and then he davens, we too should first praise Hashem and then davens. Rav Kook says, well, what's that talking about? What does that mean? Right, everybody with me here? What does that mean? Right? Very simple. Says Rav Kook, before you can begin to struggle with your ratzon, to immerse yourself in the process of tefillah, you first have to be meshabeach. You have to praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu because you have to remove from yourself the remotest possibility of the impure and the completely invalid perception that you are somehow attempting to change God's will. Because if you think that tefillah, and this is Rav Kook, and if somebody wants to find it, I'm happy to share with you where you can find it. If you think that the purpose of tefillah is to change God's will, not only does that undermine the entire process of tefillah, but that's such a dangerous thought process that it could prevent you from ever reaching the shlemut that you could be reaching. You will never be able to become all you're meant to be. The Jewish people will never be able to become all they're meant to be if we think that tefillah is about shlemut. So how do I avoid thinking that tefillah is about changing God's mind? I first immerse myself in the praise of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If I really understood how awesome Hashem is, if I really understood that Hashem created everything, if I really understood that Hashem knows everything, if I really understood that all of us are here in every moment because Hashem wills it to be so, then I would realize how ridiculous it is that I'm going to change God's mind. And only when you realize how ridiculous it is that you're going to change God's mind, then you're ready to enter the world of tefillah. And as Rav Kook, that's why it's so important that the example that Rabbi Simlai gives is Moshe Rabbeinu. Because you would think if there was ever an individual who knew that he's not about to change Hashem's mind, right? If there's an individual who knew that the whole process of tefillah is about changing myself and not changing God, it was Moshe Rabbeinu. He knew Hashem on a level that none of us can imagine. And yet even Moshe Rabbeinu realizes that he has to first be Meshabeach Hashem. He has to remove himself from the possibility he's trying to change Hashem's mind. Now, what Moshe is probably trying to do in that moment is not to change God's mind. He's trying to struggle with his own tremendous ratzon to enter Eretz Israel. Maybe the reason he's not going into Israel is because he doesn't want it enough. Maybe the Jewish people need to experience how much Moshe wants to enter Eretz Israel before they enter Eretz Israel, because that alone is valuable. Obviously that's the case, because the Torah includes this little vignette, even though Moshe doesn't enter Eretz Israel. Whatever the process that's going on there, that's the central idea. Now this is really important, because you're sitting with some kid, 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now. You have a balabas in your shul. Or it's your wife, or your husband, I don't know, who's struggling with tefillah. This is where you start. Most often, that struggle begins from a completely mistaken perception of what tefillah is all about. I want you to understand, by the way, this changed the way I daven. I can only speak for myself. Completely changed the way I daven. Right? When I say a tefillah, I'm not struggling with why Hashem doesn't give me what I want. I'm struggling with what I want, and what I'm receiving helps me in terms of understanding who I really am. Because it's only when we understand who we really are that we can figure out what we're supposed to do. And by the way, what you want is the essence of who you are. So, you understand that these are the two points. The first is that palel, tefillah, is about what I want, about ratzon, about dreaming, about imagining. And the second is that shivchosh l'kadosh baruch hu is designed to allow me to realize that I'm not meant to change Hashem's mind. And one last point, and then we'll take some questions and we'll get into the ashram. Okay? Well, you know what? I'll save this for a second. Yes, do you have questions? Yes.
So
what's your name?
Ben.
Ben, nice to meet you.
If the point is to change ourselves, then why do we have to daven to Hashem? Why can't we just meditate on this concept?
Well, again, I'm not so sure you're davening to Hashem as much as dialoguing with Hashem. Those are two very different things. Okay? Number one. Number two, the fact... Look, part of this process... Obviously, I'm taking a much longer topic and I'm trying to condense it into 10-15 minutes. Part of this process is that I'm trying to become a better human being. Okay? My ability to focus on what I really could want in this world. Like, if you look through those 18-19 tefillot, they're a list of what a person should want. Okay? Take for example the fact, the Besht, who says that nothing comes into this world unless someone wants it. Right? Putting aside for the moment the mystery of why some people want something and some people don't. Take, for example, the Beit HaMikdash. Why is there no Beit HaMikdash today? Because people don't want it enough. We could have built a Beit HaMikdash with no problem in 67. Could have built it halachically. We don't want it enough. And I'm not even talking about, the Jews sunbathing on Yom Kippur afternoon on the beach in Tel Aviv. Or the fellow who's driving, with his pork sandwich on Yom Kippur morning in Cleveland. I'm talking about us. I'm talking about you go around this Beis Medrash and just ask yourself, and I include myself in this, that we wake up this morning with an intense desire, okay, for the Beit HaMikdash. Do we even know what the Beit HaMikdash is? Why we could and should want the Beit HaMikdash? Have you ever really cried over the fact that we don't have a Beit HaMikdash? Right? So of course, if we don't want it, we're not going to get it. Now, I happen to think there's a reason we don't want it. I think that there are other issues that we need first to educate ourselves in and to educate the Jewish people in before we're ready to even want the Beit HaMikdash. I think that's part of the challenge. You have groups that are trying to get people to want the Beis Hamikdash, but there's a foundation that they're missing, right? One of those foundations, by the way, is Jewish ethics. Okay, being ethical is not the goal of Judaism, but it's definitely part of the process. So, if wanting these things makes me a better human being, and the process of struggling with those things makes me a better human being, which makes the world a better place, well, what better place to discover whether you're really a better human being than in the context of a community? It's no big deal to become a better human being on a mountaintop overlooking Nepal all on your own. It's easy to become a good human being. Just make sure you don't step on an ant. But if you can be a better human being when you're sitting next to the guy who can't stop talking in the middle of davening, and you're sitting behind the guy who keeps turning around and sneezing in your direction, and the third guy who every time he walks out he leaves his sitter and he drops it and he just annoys the heck out of you, right? So in that context, if you can become a better human being, that's more meaningful, because that's part of the challenge, is to grow not as an individual, as part of community. Any aspect of tefillah. Okay, this is a whole other topic, but if you want to know if you've arrived at something that you think is true, so one of the ways that you can measure that is if it fits every piece of the puzzle. Right? It's like, it's like the Abar Benel. We once talked about this. I love learning the Abar Benel because of the way the Abar Benel presented his issues on Chumash, okay, or Navi. What the Abar Benel basically does, right, Dan Yitzchak Abar Benel was exiled from Spain, right, wrote most of his commentary on Chumash literally in exile. And what he does basically is he goes through a section of, I don't know, story of Yosef and his brothers, and he lists all these questions. This is the first question. This is the 17th question. This is the 19th question. And some of them are unbelievable questions, right? And you finish learning the Abayei Barnea once you've already learned, you know, sort of that piece on your own. Now you go to the Abayei Barnea, amazing questions. Then he starts to respond to those questions, but he responds with one basic premise, one principle, one idea. And within the context of that idea, he says, oh, this answers the 17th question. And this, of course, answers the 13th question. And the best way to learn the Abayei Barnea is that you make a list of all the questions, right? And then when you're learning what he says, you see which question, because he doesn't say this is that question. He just calls it number 17, right? So it's true because this idea responds to every single one of his questions. So the same is true here. This idea was a beautiful idea, but it really became a part of my tefillah when I started to realize that every time I came up with an issue of tefillah, this idea was able to respond to that particular issue, whatever that issue is. Okay? Somebody else? Yeah?
Maybe if you've answered this, I'll just...
Okay.
We began talking about the Anshei Knesset Tefillah, like setting the tefillah for us. How do we avoid the curtailing of our wanting to grow and want these things by the fact that it's set for us?
Ah, okay. I want you to know that the most essential aspect, I think, by the way, of an educator, rabbi or not, is sensitivity. And I don't only mean sensitivity to a human being. That goes without saying. If somebody's sitting, you know, in front of you and they're asking you a question and you've figured out that they're not always looking for an answer, they're looking for you to hear their pain. So that's one level of sensitivity. But it's also true in terms of sensitivity to mitzvot, sensitivity to text, and everything else. Okay? Most often that question arises because we've never taken the time to really explore what the bracha is all about. You know, for example, we talk about Sim Shalom, everybody says it's tefillah for peace. Well, it's not only about peace. Even assuming that Shalom is only about peace. Okay? And it's not. What is Chayin? What is Chesed? What is Rachamim? Right? There's so many different aspects to that tefillah. Right? So studying the tefillah, exploring what it means, okay, that allows you to develop a sensitivity and to understand the brilliance of Anshei Knesset Gedolah in putting together this recipe. Having said that, then the challenge is to develop a relationship with that piece. In other words, that tefillah becomes yours, it becomes personalized when you've explored it and studied it and struggled with it, and it becomes, you know, sort of put into the context of your reality. You know, like, I'll give you an example. Maybe you need to, I'll give you an example. I have a cousin I'm very close with, and probably told you the story. She lost a son. My cousin, Benji Hillman, Shemi Kom Damo, he was Menpe in Agoz, a company commander in elite unit within Golani, and he was killed in the Second Lebanon War 3 weeks after he got married. Okay, it was a devastating experience for the entire family, like any loss is, but this was particularly painful because the entire family had just celebrated his wedding. So it really came out of the blue. And as much as I thought I understood, you know, losing a soldier, I have a lot of friends, a couple of really close friends that I lost over the years, a cousin is a whole different world. Because every simcha, everything, like we had this whole discussion about what to do with my daughter's bat mitzvah, you know, to mention it, not to mention it, it's a whole different context. Anyway, so I was with an Israelite group. We have a rabbinic interns program that some of you may have heard of. We basically take guys who are in smicha, finishing smicha, and they spend 2 weeks with us in the summer. When you finish your bechinas, you know, when you're free to go, maybe next summer or sometime you'll come. So we decided that as part of the program, we were going to go to Har Herzl and Yad Vashem, because I think that's one of the areas that people have a complete misconception in terms of what it is and what the educational questions are and the issues are, and that leads to a whole discussion. Okay, so I took these guys to Har Herzl. And I told them a story of a really close friend of mine who had a powerful impact on me. He was killed in the First Lebanon War, Ani Majid, Hashem Yikam Damo. And I went to his kever, and we were leaving our Herzl, and one of the guys was asking me a question. You know, it doesn't matter what the question was. As a result of which, I started telling him the story of a student that I was close with, who was also buried in our Herzl. His name is Dvir Morchaim, right? And we're walking out of our Herzl, and I was anyway getting into my car, they were getting in a bus, and I suddenly realized, you know, I haven't visited kever in a long time. And he was like a special project of mine when I was teaching in high school, and really he rose to the challenge and just an incredible, became a leader in his class, went to Eli, was in San Chanim, he was killed in a terrible, terrible, ridiculous accident. And so I said, you know, I haven't been to this kever in a while, I'll go back to the kever, it's 5 minutes, I haven't seen you in a while. So I told the guys goodbye, and I went back on my own into rehearsal, and I went up to, you know, it took me a couple minutes to find his kever, I haven't been there in a while, I found his kever, and I, whatever, you know, had my experience by his kever. And then I was leaving the cavern, I was walking down the steps, and I saw there's some pieces of litter on the ground. I hate litter in general, but litter in Herzl, that's a whole different level, right? And to their credit, I mean, I don't know if you've been to Herzl, but it's the most spotless place. So to see a couple of pieces of paper on the ground there was a little surprising. One of them said, like, tekes with an arrow, so I guess it was from some tekes, and it was taken off a tree and fell down. So I picked up these two, three pieces of litter, and I put them in my pocket, and I said, I'll throw them in the garbage. And I'm walking out, and I see a garbage, and I remember they were in my pocket, and I took them out, and I'm about to throw them out, and I noticed one of the pieces of paper is, like, folded. So I was curious, like, what's in the piece of paper? So I open up the piece of paper, and the paper is a letter, okay, which I have sitting on my desk, and it begins, Dvir Kasheli. And I realize that this is most probably to Dvir, to this boy, Dvir Morchaim, from his mother, whom I haven't spoken to in years. And she writes this just agonizing letter, you know, that 15 years have gone by, and I did a mental click, and I realized that's when he was killed, so it must be him. It must have been, she left it on his cover, and she talks about how, you know, every time they have a Shim Simcha, and every time they have a family Ruah, and every time they get together, they try to tell the cousins that there's another cousin that's part of the family that they don't know, and that that's Dvir, and how much they still remember him, and they love him, and they miss him, and how painful the Preda was, so unexpected, saying goodbye, and how they'll never forget him, and how whatever. And at the end she writes, so I'm going to leave this letter for you here on your camera, right? She leaves it. So by the time I read this letter, I'm already out of Herzl, and by this time I have to get somewhere, so I'm like, what should I do? So I come home, whatever, and I decided I have to call her up, which is still waiting to be done, because I'm trying to get the energy up to call her. And now you're saying Sim Shalom. Now this woman's son was killed because they were on a patrol, a routine patrol in Lebanon. It was a winter night. It was very foggy, and they were on their way back from their mission. And they were heading back into Israel. Now, when you do patrol in the day, you do what's called Rivchei Yom. You have day distances. The distance between one guy and the next guy could be from where I'm sitting all the way to that corner. So that you have a 12-man patrol, six on each side of the road. I mean, it's a long line. And the purpose of that, of course, is if somebody attacks your patrol, they can't take out a whole patrol with a grenade, whatever. Right? But at night, you don't do that. Because at night, guys can get lost. So then you have Rivchei Laila. Rivchei Laila is so close that you can almost touch a guy. You can certainly see the guy in front of you. It's like this distance, right? So he wasn't paying attention. They were tired. They were going back in. This was a seasoned group of Tzanchanim. And he let the Revachim grow. So now it's a longer column than it's supposed to be at night, and it was foggy. He also didn't notice that his Nivut, you know, that he was turning without realizing it. It's hard to stay focused, you know, on heading on an exact azimuth, you know, when you're walking through fields, right? Or you're walking on a road, you don't realize it's curving around, right? And you're in the fog. So what happened was, this line, which is supposed to be going straight, he starts curving around. These guys were sort of not noticing that they were this way. The next thing you know, him in front sees silhouettes in the fog with guns. Now, if you're in Lebanon and you see silhouettes in the fog and with guns, you don't call out who's there, right? Because then you're dead. You hit the ground and you open up. And that's what they did. And there were all sorts of lessons learned from this, and that's how Dvir was killed. And this woman, to this day, is still struggling with this because this officer was never court-martialed because his father's a brigade commander or whatever. Doesn't matter if she's right, she's wrong, it's irrelevant. This woman has no shlemut. She's not shalem. She lost her son, and she's broken. So now you're saying Sim Shalom. Is that woman in your mind? You know, is it in your mind that there's so many families that are broken? And how much you wish that they could achieve some level of shlemut? And what has to happen if you really have that thought process when you're saying Sim Shalom is not that it's up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does, because that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You don't need to tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu what to do. So what am I going to do about this? If this tefillah is real, then you're going to figure out something to do about it. So in my case, it's a phone call. You know, in your case, it might be the idea that you were perceptive enough to have a thought. That's what tefillah is supposed to be, right? And the fact that Chazal put all this stuff in this recipe, as you begin to study tefillah, I mean, I want you to understand the biggest problem with tefillah is not that it's not an incredible system. It's that we don't teach our kids what to do. We expect these boys to show up for minyan at 7 in the morning when they're ninth grade for 4 years, and we never sit down and study with them what it is that they're doing. So that's ridiculous. Of course that's ridiculous. Now, until now, you could sit and say, that's ridiculous. But now, I've set you up. Because when you go out there to start working with kids or teaching balabat, whatever it is, you won't be able to say that's ridiculous. You'll be the reason it's ridiculous. If you go to a shul, you go to a high school, you're an NCSY, or you're working with B'nai Akiva kids here in Israel, or you're in Tel Aviv working with nightclub kids, whatever area of chinuch you choose, right, you have an opportunity to change this. That's your challenge. But that challenge has to begin with studying what tefillah is all about. Okay? Make sense? And by the way, it's an interesting dilemma that I think this world is beginning to struggle with, which is, if we get guys like you, or like me 15, 20 years ago, for 3-4 years, and you're sitting and learning, so when you consider where you're going and what you're doing, if you had a year to really study the Siddur and study the Tefillah and study all these theological questions, or study Hilchos Nida and Mikvaos. Now, don't get me wrong. Look, I love to learn. I love to learn. And I miss those years. I enjoyed learning Nida and Mikvaos. It was amazing. And especially Mikvaos, when you can go to real Mikvaot and test the Machloktin against the measurements sitting in the Mikvah and the Gush. That was amazing. But if I ask myself whether that was the best use of my time, considering what it is that I'm choosing to do, I'm not so sure. So I'm not a gadol enough to make an opinion on it, but at least we have the right to ask that question. It's a difficult question. And I used to, I wouldn't say I ridiculed or made fun of, but betochi, like inside, I had big pukim. I had doubts. I have a cousin I'm close with, and he did one of these 1-year smicha. You know, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who's a tremendous gadol b'Torah. And you can get smicha with Rav Zalman Nechemia in 3 months, in 6 months, whatever it might be. And I used to think, like, you know, what kind of serious rav goes to, you know, Chabad, they do a 6-month smicha. Okay, granted, they have to learn a little beforehand. And now I struggle with that because on the other end, because on the one hand, like, when I meet somebody who did smicha 3-4 years and took the rabbinut test or whatever, so I realize that's a serious person. On the other hand, I don't know. It's a difficult question. But this topic has to be somewhere in your framework. It has to be a part of what you're struggling to develop and to relate to and to teach and to share and to grow it. Okay, somebody else here had a question. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, we have this general idea that davening, like, at least growing up in Israel, I grew up in Israel, there's this form of basically like we need to be humble enough to not ask things for ourselves, as if like we have to daven about like there's this like skew idea of what anava is, I feel, in our community, in like with my friends, as if like I'm worth nothing, everyone else is everything, and like kind of like when you daven, I'm just saying when you daven, like often, like there's this thing that like you're trying to daven for the whole world, and as if you feel bad to daven for yourself, for what you need, for your...
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
There are guys sitting here, and I can't speak for the ladies because I don't know whatever it is, but I happen to think that that's also part of the challenge, because if you're, you know, married to a fellow who is going into chinuch, then you've basically signed up for the Rebbetzin track, you know? This was the greatest wool I pulled over my wife's eyes ever, okay? I did not want to marry someone who wanted to be a Rebbetzin. Didn't bother me. And I married someone who definitely was not interested in being a Rebbetzin, and that's great. She likes to say there's a certain type of person who has their feet firmly planted in the air. That would have been me. And my wife grounds me, it's a bracha. But having said all that, and you can attest that because you've met my wife, right? Having said all that, when you enter this world, you end up being involved. So you're sitting around the Shabbos table with students, and they ask questions, right? So the first question is, what is anava? The second question is how it relates to tefillah. Anava does not mean I'm nothing.
No, I know that. I know that it's a skewed understanding of what anava is, but yet people still have that understanding of like as if what you explain tefillah is that if I daven for something, I'm bringing the will of what I want to happen in the world, and therefore it will happen, please God. Like with no connection of God making it happen, it's like basically I'm davening, I'm making it happen by me davening for it.
That's not exactly how I look at it. In other words, the way I understand it, the way I think Rav Kook understands it, although it's a complicated question, part of what you say is definitely true. But before you get to what is accomplished in the world in terms of bringing Ratzon into the world and how that affects the world, first you have to get to the point of the fact that I change. And the fact that I change means that the world on some level changes with me.
Yeah.
Okay? But ultimately the question of tefillah is what I do with that Ratzon. In other words, you know, if I stand all day on mountaintops and I'm willing to change into the world, but I'm not doing anything to change it, something is always missing. And there are many stories like this. You know, the best example I can think of is Choni HaMe'agel. Okay, you know the story of Choni HaMe'agel, right? So Choni, basically there's no rain, and Choni stands on a mountaintop and he draws a circle, and he basically tells Hashem, I'm not stepping outside of the circle until you bring rain, and there's a whole discussion, what kind of rain, torrents, this, whatever. What's really going on there? Right? What's really going on there is that Choni, well, one way of understanding what's going on there is that Choni HaMe'agel, on a certain level, is trying to change who Choni is. And through Choni, okay, he's trying to change his generation. That's the essence of what goes on with Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is up on Har Sinai. Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Lech Reid Kishichet Amcha, right, go down, because, you know, the people are become destructive. Moshe doesn't listen to him. Moshe stands up on Har Sinai and starts to argue with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Zachor l'Avraham l'tzchak l'Yakov shen shabbat l'msham. Remember what you promised Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. Lama yomru mitzrayim l'mor. In backwards order, right? What are the Egyptians going to say? So what? Moshe's trying to change Hashem's mind? Moshe's not trying to change Hashem's mind. Moshe's trying to change Moshe. Because if a Moshe can stand up on top of Har Sinai and allow the Jewish people to be in the Chet HaEgel, the first person that has to change is Moshe Rabbeinu. What sort of leadership is that? So Moshe is trying to change Moshe, and with Moshe, somehow, the Jewish people are changing as well, and when we change, then we're entitled to a different world. But with that different world that we're given, now we have to decide what to do with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's a process. Mm-hmm. It's dangerous to try to figure out the whole thing in 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Having said that, it's at least the beginning of a direction. You know, I think that it's very difficult sometimes for people to make a paradigm shift. People are just so used to the fact that you go into shul and you're asking God to do something, and then you get to see whether God does it. Like, you hear that famous story. You know, God heard what you asked and God said no. No. That's just not pshat. It's not that Hashem heard you and Hashem said no. Right? It's that Hashem heard you, but you didn't hear you. You don't really want it enough. You're not really willing to change enough. Right? Because as far as Hashem's response, I don't know. I don't consider myself worthy to really understand Hashem's end of the deal. We know that Hashem said no. We know Hashem said yes. We know what Hashem wants. I have no idea. I can at least think about where I'm at. That I can think about. Make sense? And in terms of the topic of anava, so that's a very delicate balance. If anava really means not I am nothing, but I am actually everything, except that that everything is a gift. Right? If you are, I don't know, what's the name of that guy who's the Tour de France Armstrong, is that
Lance.
His name? Right, Lance Armstrong. So Lance Armstrong, you know, somebody says he's the greatest bike rider, and he says, oh, not me, I don't buy it. Then he's an idiot. He should know that he's a great bike rider, but he shouldn't get too full of himself, because that's a gift that he was given. And he had to decide what to do with it, right? So if his bike riding is all about, you know, that he wants to make a lot of money, so then that's a waste. But if his bike riding is that he can help children who are, you know, b'dikaon, right, depressed in hospitals, and he can change their lives. So that's amazing, right? Michael Jordan, you know, they tell a story about Rothschild. And since I think I heard it from Riskin, so you must know the story, but they tell a story about him at the end of his life. You know, he wanted to examine his books. Did you ever hear the story? No? Yes? Maybe? Okay. Wow. Okay. So he must have been in the class that week. Anyway, So they tell a story about him. He's at the end of his life, right? This is the Baron. This is Moneybags, right? And he calls in the accountant. He's near the end of his life. He wants to know, like, you know, what do I have? How much am I worth? He says, well, okay, you know. He says, no, really, I want you to look at the books. I want you to understand what we owe, what we gain, whatever. Fine. So he takes a couple days. He goes through all the books. He comes back to him with a number. So Rothschild looks at him. He goes, that can't be right. He goes, you got to tell me how you got this number, because I had a different number. So the guy says, well, you know, I looked at these books and whatever. So he looks like, ah, those are the wrong books. Those are the books of what we have in the bank. That doesn't interest me. I want to know what we gave away, because that's the only thing I really have. Right? So that's the essence. It's not what you're given. It's what you do with it. It's what a difference you make with it. And that's all wrapped up in tefillah. And this dialogue, and I'm not, you know, on a rampage to convince kids to daven, but I at least want to know that if a kid is struggling with what tefillah is, that he's met someone who has a logical perception of what tefillah is about, so that it makes sense to him. That's the first step. You know, when a kid meets a Rebbe who has no idea why we daven, so then that tells him that Judaism is ridiculous, because he's not sophisticated enough to realize that the Rebbe is ridiculous. And chas v'shalom, I'm not putting down the Rabbanim who teach in Jewish high schools. They're tremendous Talmidei Chachamim, and they do tremendous work, and some of them have enormous impact on these kids. But I'm saying, in this particular department, we have a lot of work to do. Okay? Yes? No? Okay. So now we've said that, now we can take a look at this piece of the Ashrei. And I think that this is the lens through which it's worth studying different pieces of tefillah, but that's just me. You can decide what to do with it. So take a look at this, okay? So, there is, I think maybe the way to do this is actually first to share with you a Gemara, because otherwise we won't get to this. The Gemara says like this. It's a Gemara in... Do I have the Gemara here?
We have it.
I think you have it, so I must have it. Right. Maybe I gave it to you. Hang on. Okay. Yeah, is this right? Okay. A little different. Shkayach. So I'm Rabbi Lazar, I'm Ravina. Kola Omer Tilala David, right? Tilala David is the Ashrei. Okay. B'chol Yom Shalosh Pamim, Muvtach Lo Shuben Olam Haba. That's an amazing statement. All you have to do, Olam Haba, Ashrei three times. Who in his right mind wouldn't say Ashrei if he knew he could get into Olam Haba? Now this raises two obvious questions. What are these two questions?
What's so special about the Ashrei?
Okay, you want to go that way? Okay, what's so special about the Ashrei? And if you're already in the Ashrei, what else? Pardon? Yeah, what's Olam Haba? Like, what's Olam Haba? I want you to know. You talk to a 17-year-old. He's in 11th grade. And he knows if he passes his driver's license that his dad's going to get him a car. He could care less what you think Olam Haba is. He thinks Olam Haba is a Corvette. That's it. So if you tell him that saying Ashrei three times is going to get him the Corvette, you're in. If not, lo mayin ta safta shalom, right? Doesn't interest him, right? What is Olam Haba? Why do I want to get there? We're not really going to get to what Olam Haba is. That's an important discussion. It's reasonable to assume that most people have a very different perception. If we went around this room and asked everybody what Olam Haba is, I'm willing to bet that for the number of people in this room, that's how many different perceptions we would get. And it's worth studying what that is. In fact, there's even a Hasidic idea that Olam Haba is the Olam that's Ba, that's coming. It's that world the way it should be, right? It's your ability to be in that world the way it should be, but you never actually get there. It's always Ba. If you ever got there, right, then you failed. Okay, that's a whole discussion. And the Rambam in the Morne Vuchim has a whole discussion about the fact, in Akadam al-Perichelik, who says that Olam Haba is the product of a feast of intellectual delights. In other words, why is it that in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, in Perichelik, that there are certain people who don't have a chelik in Olam Haba? If you don't believe in Tchiyat HaMeitim, you have no chelik in Olam Haba. That's what the Gemara says. What's Tchiyat HaMeitim? Does everybody here know what Tchiyat HaMeitim is? That you could even say, I believe in it. You can't believe in something if you don't know what it is. So if you don't know what Tchiyat HaMeitim is, so then you don't believe it. So you have no chelik in Olam Haba. That's depressing, right? I mean, the good news is if you get into Olam Haba, you'll have lots of room because most of the world won't get in there because they have no idea what Tchiyat HaMeitim is. And if you go through Perek Chelik and Sanhedrin, you'll find out that there's lots of other things that we have no idea what they are, right? So the Rambam says, no. Olam Haba is the product. It's the result of certain accomplishments in this world. It's like it's like getting into calculus, 101 in Harvard. Right? If you didn't study any physics or algebra or whatever, that's why I went to Chinuch, because I don't care what calculus is, but if you didn't study those things, you're not going to get calculus. It's not that you're punished, you're not there. So there's certain things that you need to be able to wrap your hands around in this world in order to experience whatever Olam Haba is, intellectually. That's how the Rambam looks at it. There are different ways of looking at Olam Haba. But what this does tells me is, if I really want to understand what the Ashrei is, I got to figure out what I think Olam Haba is. That's something to work on. And then, of course, the second question is, what is the Ashrei? Why do I have to say it three times a day? So, the Gemara is going to address this question, right? My timer, right? Why does Ashrei so important? Why does it get me to Olam Haba, right? So there are two possibilities, okay? Ilema mishum de'atya ba'alav bet. If you say it's because it appears in the form of Aleph Beis. Now, Aleph Beis is a very important form because it implies totality, implies completion. Right, the 22 letters of the alphabet represent sort of everything, right? So the fact that a tehillah is according to the alphabet means it encompasses everything. So that's powerful. Not sure why, but we'll get to that. Neima ashrei tmimei derech da'atya betmanyap. Right, you could have tehillim kuf yutet, which we say sometimes at the graveyards, at batei kvarot, which has every letter of the alphabet 8 times. So if you're going to say something's important to say because there's an alphabet, so say kuf yutet, which has each letter 8 times. Now, fortunately, nobody listened to this opinion, and that's why we get out of mincha earlier. But understand, right? So they say, Ela mishum de'it be potech et yadecha. Say no, because of one pasuk, the pasuk of potech et yadecha. That pasuk potech et yadecha, the fact that Hashem sustains all, whatever that means, is the essence of why Ashrei is so critical. So then the Gemara says, Neima halel hagadol. If the whole idea is potech et yadecha, choose to say the halel hagadol. Dichtiv be noten lechem l'chol basar. On some level, noten lechem l'chol basar, that Hashem feeds all living creatures, right? As opposed to chol chai ratzon, the fact that Hashem sustains everything is a higher level than Hashem sustains all the living creatures of the world, right? So that's a more valuable parak, right? Ella mishum de it beit talti. No, because it has both. So neither of these two other tefillot, the kuf yutet and halal agadol, has both, but the ashrei has both. And then we get into a discussion of why we don't say the nun. Right? Okay, we won't get into that. I don't think we're going to get there. So now this is interesting. This is a critical tefillah. It's not really a tefillah, it's more. It's an introduction of sorts. It's so important that it's one of the only three things that we say three times a day, right? We say the Shema three times a day, we say Shemona Esrei three times a day, and we say Ashrei three times a day. Okay? And maybe a Val Tzion, but that's a different discussion. Right? That makes this very important. Why is this so important? Well, it's important because it has two things. It has the Aleph Beis, and it has Potech et Yadecha. Whatever that means. Now, what do you do with this? What do you do with this? First of all, just out of curiosity, how many people, before we started today, were aware on some level of this Gemara? That they had seen this somewhere or whatever? Okay. So some of us have seen this before. What would you do with that question? Because before we get to where Rav Kook does, what would you do with that question? It's a good question, right? What is the Ashrei? There are obviously two central ideas that are critical for whatever the Ashrei accomplishes. And obviously what the Ashrei accomplishes is to get us into Olam Haba. In other words, you have to understand, the reason that I'm saying Ashrei, the word reason is a dangerous word, but we'll use it for now. The reason that I'm saying the Ashrei, right, this afternoon before Mincha, is because somehow that's going to get me into Olam Haba. Okay? So agree with me that if I have no idea what Olam Haba is, I'm not very motivated to say the Ashrei. So if you're teaching high school kids, or you're balabatim, right, or I don't know what level of chinuch you're interested in, or just for yourself, maybe you're not going into chinuch, you're here learning. At a certain point, you're not as motivated to say the Ashrei if you don't understand what the purpose of it is. So that's number one. Number two, there are clearly two critical ideas in the Ashrei that are so valuable that it's worth saying them three times a day. One of them is the Aleph Bet, and one of them is Potech et Yadecha. So now let's take a look at what Rav Kook says. Okay? So Rav Kook says like this. Right? And I'm going to... What time are we supposed to stop? I forgot to ask. 4:30, okay. So I'm going to get us started on this, but I'm going to leave you this piece to struggle with and to think about, because to my mind, that's the most valuable part of a process. And when you're left with a question, you struggle with it, and then it's a shame we get back or via email. So, Ha'inyan ha-miyuchad shel Ashrei. Do you see that? Right? Ha-mechupal b'kdushat alfa beta. In other words, the special inyan of Ashrei, in that it has both the Aleph Beis and the Potech et Yadecha, hamore al etzem hashlemut shel hasagat kol shafaot orot hadat. That's fascinating to me. Okay, the Ashrei is somehow the ability to arrive at shlemut on all of the different levels of dat. Now, what do you think that that means? What do you think that means? Anybody? What's the obvious question there? What is that? Let's assume for the moment that that is about relationships. Okay? Let's assume that that is about relationships. Okay? This we've definitely discussed before. Vayeda Adam et Chava Ishto. And Adam knew Eve, in a biblical sense, whatever that means, right? Means that da'at is about relationships, right? Mitzvah gedolah la'da'at she'esh amalah, perhaps the mitzvah to develop a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay? So the Ashrei, on a certain level, is the hasagot kol shva'ot orot ha'da'at. All of the opportunities to develop, to experience what Hashem brings to us in terms of developing relationships. Relationships with Hashem, relationships with ourselves, relationships with the world around us. That is the ultimate introduction to tefillah. Right? If tefillah is all about what I could want and who I really am, first I have to understand how I relate to everything around me. Right? That's the first thing. What's the second thing? V'harchakat kol hatirdot hamafriot mehasagat ha-tachlit. And it's about distancing yourself, right, from all of the interferences the distractions, the things that prevent you from accomplishing whatever it is you're meant to accomplish in this world. In other words, there are two issues here. One is trying to figure out who you are and where you're trying to get to. And the other is trying to figure out what prevents you from getting there. Somehow, the ashray contains the secret to both of those ideas. You with me so far? Pardon? On the one hand, there's who I am and where I'm trying to get to, right? In other words, if I'm born, you know, take me for example. So, how is it that I ended up a teacher? Hopefully a good teacher. Well, because I was born to a particular set of parents who were amazing teachers. And I grew up in a shul, right? I mean, I was hearing the shiurim that you're hearing from Rivkin when I was 10 years old. And I had amazing rebbeim. And if you put those pieces of recipe together in a pot, so ipso facto, you get a teacher. That's just what you get. Nothing to do with me. Now the challenge is, okay, so if that's the recipe and that's all the stuff that was put in my, you know, in my bowl, in my suitcase, so now I got to figure out what to do with it. So that's the first piece. The first piece is to take a look. What are the relationships in my life? What are the things that are brought to me? How is it that I ended up here at a Miftar in Eretz Yisrael in Gush Etzion? Who are my rebbeim? Who am I looking for? How do I relate to myself? How do I relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? All of that, the context of all of that, when you put that all together, that's how I figure out who I am and what I'm meant to do. But then there's the second piece. Second piece is, so what's preventing me from getting there? People very often focus on one without the other. They're so busy focusing on what's preventing them from learning, they're not really focusing on what they could be learning. Right? It's like the pasuk Sur Meirah V'Aseh Tov. Some people focus on the Sur Meirah, turn away from evil. They're so busy making sure that when they go into town, that they, I don't know, they don't hear Lashon Hara. Right? So they'll sit at the table, and if somebody walks by, and he's speaking Lashon Hara, they'll say, they won't hear Lashon Hara. There's another way to deal with Lashon Hara. Just talk Torah all the time. Okay? I challenge you to go sit down with Rav Nachum Schrader and start talking Lashon Hara. You won't be able to do it. He just won't let you do it. Right? He'll just start with a Vart, and you'll be done for 3 hours. Right? By the time you're done, you'll forget your Lashon Hara. Right? Can't talk Lashon Hara to certain people. Rav Tversky was like that. Impossible to talk Lashon Hara to Rav Tversky. Impossible. In fact, I had a bet with somebody and I tried it. And he just, let's talk about more pleasant things. Just, we couldn't get there. It's just impossible, right? So there's Sur Meirah, focus on not doing good. And then there's Aseh Tov, immerse yourself in good. Those are two different sides. One is figuring out who I am. What is the Tov that I am? And the other is the Sur Meirah. What are the things that prevent me from getting there, right? Okay? All right. Right? Now, bear that in mind, okay? Because he actually gets here to a discussion of why the nun is missing in Ashrei, and how the nun represents the nefilah of Galut, and why it is that in Galut we cannot achieve these things, and how that's hidden in the message of the Ashrei, which is a very important topic, but we're going to skip, right? Look to the second page. I don't know if you photostated my page or not, but there's an arrow if you did. But look, you see where it says Potech et Yadecha? Okay? So this is really what we're doing. Okay, that was just an introduction. So you remember that this was sort of the piece that, you know, Rav Kook takes two parts. He takes the part of the Gemara that talks about the Nefilah, and then he takes the part that talks about why Ashrei is great, right? Potech et Yadecha, Amar Rabbi Elazar Baravina, Kol Omer Tilal David B'chol Yom, Gimel Pa'amim, Muftach Lo Shuben Olam Haba, Mai Taima Ilei Mishum Deit Yavah Alef Bet, Neima Ashrei Tmim Yederech, Da'ati Betmanya, Apim. Ela mishum deit pei potech tadecha, neima halalagad dechtiv bei noten lecho basar. Ela mishum deit pei tate, right? The Gemara and Brachos, we have both. We have potech tadecha, and we also have the Aleph Beis. Okay. Ha-hachana. Now listen to this. This is amazing. Ha-hachana. The preparation. She-yachin ha-adam et atzmo el ha-shlemut ha-amitit. That allows a person to prepare himself for real shlemut. Remember we started this whole discussion, how do you get to shlemut? Right? Tiyeh al yedei shnei dvarim. It occurs through two things. Ha'echad, shi'ya'ir lo or ha'sechel hanovea mitorah kdosha ladat et kono. This is the first. The first is that intellectually, you're able, through Torah, to discover a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, when Rav Kook uses the word kono, that's a lashon of kinyan, right? That's all about relationships. In fact, why is it that a katan is not able to make a kinyan, right? Dedabe mabe u delo dabe, right? Dedabe kule be u delo dabe mabe. When a person has it, he has everything. When he doesn't have it, what does he have? That's talking about dad. It's So why is a katan not able to make a kinyan, a minor? Because he doesn't have the ability to create relationships. Right? That's why you can't give a katan, a minor, your arba minyan. Right? Because if you give it to him, he can take it, but you can't give it back. Right? So kono is that aspect of Hashem in which I'm developing a relationship with Hashem. Torah is the vehicle for developing a relationship with Hashem. And this is the first piece. The first way that one achieves, the first essential factor in achieving shlemut, which may be perfecting our purpose in this world, right? That's what shlemut really is, that we're totally on board with why we're here and what our purpose is. So the first is, you know, through Torah, to develop that relationship, right? Ladak et kono. Okay? This is the same as the first thing I mentioned before. Hashlemut shel hasagat kol shapaot orot hadat. Okay, the totality of understanding all the relationships in my life and how Hashem brings those into the world. Ve'hasheni, and the second, shelo yelo mafriya mitardot ha'olam hazeh. That he isn't disturbed, distanced, sent off track by those disturbances in this world. V'hinei af misha ol sichlo tamid imo. Even someone... Now, there are different ways to understand this. My way of understanding Misha ol sichlo tamid imo is the Talmud Chacham. Somebody who's just immersed in Torah. He has tremendous sechel. He's immersed in attempting to know his Creator through Limud Torah. Right? But even such a person, Efshar sheyifsha v'yate midarech hayashar al yedei hatradot hamatridot oto. Sometimes he becomes distracted. He becomes sidetracked by those tirdot, those obstacles, those burdens that prevent him from remaining immersed in his development, in his relationship with Hashem through Torah. And you don't have to go far to figure this out. You can look in the newspapers to see what I mean by this. Right? Umnam hamizgav lehinatzel misvach hatirdot hu habitachon. How is one able to be saved from this maze of burdens, of obstacles, of things that prevent me from accomplishing what I'm meant to accomplish, right? That's bitachon. Bitachon. Al kein af nisgav hu hashevach shenemar ve'alef bet. Now I can finally get to why this whole mahalach makes sense. Because what does Rav Kook say here? And maybe somebody here is sitting like, okay, chaval, because we got into the ashray, now it's like the end of the class, but why do we have that whole introduction? I don't know how anybody could understand this unless they understood that idea from Rav Kook. What does Rav Kook call the Aleph Beis? Remember, there are two aspects to the ashray. There's the Aleph Beis, and then there's Potech et Adecha. What is the Aleph Beis? The Aleph Beis is HaShevach. What does Rav Kook say Shevach is? Shevach is the necessary prelude to Tefillah. Why? Because in Shevach, I immerse myself in the totality, in the awesomeness of everything Hashem is, so that I know that the purpose of Tefillah is not to change Hashem's mind. What is that? What is it when I immerse myself in the totality of what Hashem is? That's Bitachon. And I want you to understand what a critical factor this is in everything that we do, but especially in Jewish education. Okay? I just had an interesting discussion. We were sitting with the interns, and you know, it's a balance between, you know, topics that are more theological, and maybe, you know, Tamei HaMitzvot, and Hedashir Tefillah and Mitzvot, and different things, and topics that are more practical. So we were having a discussion about fundraising. You know, if you decide that you want to go into the world of outreach, education, chinuch, whatever label you give it, eventually you're going to have to get involved in fundraising. And maybe that fundraising isn't the thing you love the most. It wasn't why I went into chinuch, right? But, you know, if you want to do great things, you have to find the funds, and you can't depend on everybody else to do it for you. And of course, the catch there is that if you're going to do anything, do it well. And in order to do something well, you have to love it. So that means that if you become a rav in a shul, or a high school rebbe, or anywhere in between, right, you actually have to figure out a way to fall in love with fundraising. Otherwise, there will be forever projects that you will not be able to get your hands around. Right? Okay? What's the essential problem with fundraising? As in many things, pitach. Why is it that when people get stuck in fundraising and they have to raise funds for projects, it affects them so much? Because they lose their bitachon. The tirdot of this world distract them from the essence of their relationship with their Kodesh Baruch. Do you understand that? I'll give you an example. You walk into a fellow, he's a multi-millionaire. how it is you got a meeting with him and how you developed a relationship with him is a separate deal. Okay, so you go to meet with him, and you're all nervous because you're going to ask him for $100,000, and you know that if he gives you $100,000, that you could bring 1,000 kids from Russia this summer and change their lives. And you're doing this lishma, right? You're not doing this because you want to be the one who created the project, and you're not doing this because you want to get in good with the donor. Like, let's assume that that shtus isn't yet in your lexicon, and you're actually doing this for the right reasons. And you go in there, and you're devastated. Because he says he'll give you $5,000. So you had $100,000 in your mind. He gave you $5,000. Putting aside for the moment that if he gave you $5,000, it's because really he had $5,000 in your mind. Putting that aside for the moment, okay? You're devastated, because how are you going to find $95,000? Do you understand what a tremendous lack of bitachon that is? Do you understand that if this project is going to happen, it's because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it to happen. And if this project is not going to happen, it doesn't matter how much you want it to happen, it's not going to happen. So why is it that you're going to this donor? You're not going to this donor because you're asking for money. That's a separate topic. That's the vehicle through which you're developing a relationship with this fellow. You're going to this donor because you're an educator. And you have a chance to be an educator. But that's a question of bitachon. The tirdot of this world undermine the fact that really you're at your root supposed to be an educator. Right? And this is true for every topic. You're sitting with a student, and maybe he's a birthright student. And he's dating an Episcopalian girl, and you're devastated. And so you get together with him, you spend all night talking to him, you spend weeks talking to him, and then he calls you up and he says, look, I know this is tough for you, but I want to invite you to the wedding. So you're devastated. And he gets married. That's very difficult, right? Now, I can't tell you why he got married, and I can't tell you what's going to happen with his marriage, but I can tell you he was meant to get married. You know how I know he was meant to get married? Because he got married. Because Baruch wanted him to get married. I don't know why. That may be a very difficult thing to say. But that's what happened. How do you balance the tirdot of this world with bitachon? That is the ashrei. Every pasuk of the ashrei is a different aspect of the shevach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's a longer discussion. And the totality of the ashrei is the ability to immerse yourself in the totality of the fact that Hashem runs the world. You want to know why you say ashrei at mincha? Right? You don't say shema at mincha. Right? You say the Shemona Esrei, but before you say the Shemona Esrei, which is tefillah, you say the Ashrei, because in the middle of my business day, in the middle of all the stuff that I'm struggling with, I take a step back and I realize Hashem runs the world. I want you to know, if you really understood that Hashem runs the world, you could never have a bad day. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a challenge day. It doesn't mean that there isn't tremendous work to do, because Kadosh Baruch Hu isn't waiting for me to do this. I still have to do my part. Right? It's like the Sefer HaChinuch says with Hilchos Tzedakah. Right? If you think that the reason that there's a mitzvah to give tzedakah because the poor person needs money, you've missed the boat. That's not the purpose of the mitzvah of tzedakah, says Lachina. Because if that was the purpose, then Hashem wouldn't need you. He'd just give the money to the poor person. The reason that there's a mitzvah for tzedakah is because you need to be giving to the poor person. You need to have a relationship with that particular poor person, and he needs to receive it from you. There's all sorts of stuff going on. Now that creates all sorts of theological questions. Hashem creates poor person in order that I should do it. That's a whole other question. But you understand, that's all about pitachon. And that's the ashrei. And then the second piece is, if I can immerse myself in that shevach, then I'm struggling with, okay, so what do I do now? Because Hashem b'chol zot put me in the world. That's poteach et yadecha mesbilachol chai ratzon. The essence of poteach et yadecha mesbilachol chai ratzon is my ability to struggle with the fact that even though Hashem runs the world, that even though Hashem gives everything, that I still have to struggle with how I become a vehicle in that happening. And the balance of those two things is the essence of the ashrei. This is amazing. Right? ובסגולת אמירתו יאירו עליו אורות התורה הקדושה בחלם. אבל אם כל זה עוד לא הגיע לחפץ עד שיהיה גם כן שלם בביטחון. If you're not שלם in your ביטחון, you didn't get שבח. You didn't get that Hashem runs the world. והביטחון עצמו עוד לא יועיל לו, כי אם בהיותו על ידי מנוחת נפשו משתלם לדעת את קונו. You also have to immerse yourself in that bitachon, to then develop a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's a different problem. And lastly, kol asher tuchal nafsho se'et me'orot ha'torah shtuchal la'avileim al kein az hu muftach l'olam haba b'yot bo shnei eile. Right? He has, on the one hand, right, shekoneh ha'idei tila v'david ha'mu ba'alef beit v'yesh bo poteach et yadecha ha'me'ir et ha'bitachon u'me'sir et ha'tirda. In other words, the ashrei is the immersion in the totality of shevach, and the essence of shevach, which is potech et yadecha, the reality that Hashem gives you everything, so that while you're immersing yourself in the world of what you have to do, you remember that ultimately it's up to Hashem to give it.
That balance is the ashrei. And that connects so beautifully with the larger idea of tefillah. So that's a little bit of food for thought. One last just word to say, and then if anybody has any questions, and that is that this is the Alat HaRiyah. I cannot tell you what an incredible sefer this is. I don't think it's translated into English. Maybe I'm wrong. It should be. Maybe somebody here will actually decide to do it. But I will tell you that if you want to study tefillah, this is an amazing book. And if you feel that your Hebrew is not up to it, demand a shiurim. And if that doesn't happen, then when you leave, you get a chavrusa in it. Just the introduction, before you even get to the tefillot, could take you a year. It's like 70 pages or something, but it's challenging Hebrew. But the ideas in there are unbelievable. Unbelievable ideas. And I would highly recommend struggling with and studying the Alat HaRiyah. That's just as an aside. Even if it takes you 10 years, and you do a little bit here and a little bit there, and you study these pieces. I have a close friend, Rav Murray Shaum, who was my Rebbe Chavir in Sfas Emes. And when he started, he got me into learning Sfat Emet, so he gave me a very good piece of advice. He said, listen, don't try to learn Sfas Emes Kaseder, because some of those, you know, Pikkuler are very, very hard. He said, you know, when you get to a Parsha, so read through a few of them and see one that at least seems like you connect to it. And work on that one. So that's how I first learned the Alat HaRiyah. There are some pieces that take a long time to struggle with, and there are some pieces you get them. So read through it. You know, you could find one a week, and it could change the way you do. Anyway, that's a little food for thought. There are obviously a lot of topics that open up in this window. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to fully understand the presentation in terms of prep of tefillah that you presented. I think I've got the first half. The second half I don't understand. Tefillah is for ourselves to listen to ourselves, that we can then change and see the requests we're making. They might be the wrong requests because we might need to be a different person. Where is the second half of God responding or not responding? I didn't understand where God is in tefillah.
First of all, just to be clear, we're only touching the tip of the iceberg, one aspect of tefillah. There are many, many different aspects. You are definitely also having a dialogue with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We just didn't get to explain that. That's number one. Number two, in other words, the entry point to tefillah is that I'm struggling with who I am and what I want, and here's a recipe of the things that I could want, and then if I can really tap into the things that I want, right, that I should want, that I could want, then that empowers me to become a better person, a different person, and causes me to struggle with why I was put here. Now I can make the world a better place. Now, all of that is within the context of my relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, right? If I get into what I could want and what I could do, that all stems from the question of why I was put here. In other words, if Hashem doesn't exist in my life, then I'm random. Then it makes no difference what I want. And it makes no difference what I could do, because what's the difference? So part of the aspect of tefillah is also developing a relationship with Hashem. In other words, you know, if you enter into tefillah from the ashrei, and you get, for example, to the tefillah of, I don't know, Rafainu, so you're struggling with the fact that someone is sick, because it should pain you that there's someone sick. It should pain you that anyone's sick. And the process of struggling with that and wanting people to be healthy, right, makes you a better human being. And you start to ask yourself, well, why do I want these people to be healthy? What do I think they could do? What could the world be? Who am I? What would I do if this person was, et cetera, et cetera. But alongside that is the reality that at the end of the day, it's Hashem that created the world, and Hashem that allows or chooses or causes people to be sick. And therefore, I'm constantly within the confines of that tension. That on the one hand, Hashem made a person sick, so that person's meant to be sick. On the other hand, that person's sick within the context of the fact that the world was the way it was this morning. But if 100,000 people now daven for this person, then the world is a different world, and anything is possible. Make sense? Yes.
How do you?
What's your name?
Dan.
Dan, nice to meet you.
How do you? If a lot of people are sort of. What do you view as the sort of the function of tefillah
b'tzibur
in that regard?
Oh, okay. I mentioned that a little before, but tefillah b'tzibur is the attempt to achieve that shleimut within the context of a community. That's the first level. In other words, let's say you want to be...
I think you said that more as a challenge.
Pardon?
That you cited that more as a challenge.
Well, it's not so much a challenge. I'll give you an example. Okay. Let's say
You're the director of the Red Cross. You're raising funds all over the world for people who are homeless, okay? And you're on your way to work one morning. And you're on your way to the subway, and you have an important meeting. And there's some homeless guy there, and he comes over and he asks you for help. And you're too busy. There's something wrong with that paradigm, right? You're so busy saving the homeless, you forget the homeless, okay? So Judaism says that part of your ability to maintain and develop that sensitivity is that your tefillah, your personal dreams and wishes, they're grappled with within the context of the community. In other words, like, I can only say how this impacted my experience in tefillah. Maybe it's a little different because I'm also sometimes a Baal Tefillah, but for example, if it's Rosh Hashanah, and you're going up for the Amud, you know, and say I'm davening my minyan, so you put a tremendous amount of effort into considering who the people are in shul. And can you take into account all the pain and all the challenges and all the issues that these people have, machloktin that might exist, etc. Is that a part of your tefillah? Does it bother you? Does it pain you? Do you wish for it to be better? Right? Are you struggling? Okay? So that doesn't exist unless you're in the context of community. Right? That's one way of looking at it. You know, and you know, there's also an interplay in terms of the relationships that happen. In other words, if tefillah is the experience of struggling with who we are and what we want, and we do it as a group, then we become connected with our community on a deeper level. That's also healthy. That's also part of what tefillah wants. And maybe one last thought. What is the purpose of Judaism? Why do we need Jews? So one way to understand this is obviously a broader topic, is Kedoshim Tiyu. That you shall be Kadosh. Batem Tiyu Li Mamlecha Koni. V'goy Kadosh. So what does it mean to be Kadosh? So there are different explanations of what Kedusha is. I like Rav Cook's, which I think is very similar to Rav Shimshon of Halersh, which is that Kedusha is anything that becomes a vehicle, okay, for bringing Hashem into the world. Right? You take this cup, right? If you fill it up with Kiddush, it becomes a vehicle for bringing Hashem into the world. Kedusha, right? So there are certain things which are only said with a minyan. What things? Dvarim should be Kedusha. Why? Because in order to bring Hashem into the world and develop a relationship with Hashem, what does it mean to bring Hashem into the world? It means Hashem is already in the world. Bringing Hashem into the world means that I become aware of Hashem in the world. I become more aware of Hashem in the world within the context of community, together. Right? When I appreciate the differences and the different perspectives we have, I become more aware of the totality of what is in this world. And that brings Hashem into the world. I mean, it's a much more involved discussion. And it's not all intellectual. It has to also be emotional and it has to be experiential. But, okay? You want to ask something?
What's your Hebrew name?
My Hebrew name? Binyamin Moshe. So Binny is just short for Binyamin. That's, I got away from the bunny, the Binny bunny, but I never got away from the Binnies. I just stuck with it. All right, Bosai, I wish you tremendous hatzlacha on your bechinot. We look forward to seeing you next year. Mr. Hashem, have an amazing summer.
Okay, sure. The idea by Rav Cook that you just cited about Kedushin to you.
Yeah.
Where do you find that?
That's a good question. Where did I first see that? I believe that's in Orot HaKodesh. And I actually think it's one of the first Ma'amarim Vorot HaKodesh, I think. But it permeates everything he says. You can find
all Alaria on the Kedusha is a beautiful Ma'amar and Alaria.
Oh, right. Kedusha, you can also, yeah. He also alludes to it. If you understand this idea, you'll get what the Olat HaRiyah says on Kedusha.
And develop a Kedusha for the Ma'amash.
Right.
Defines Hashem.
Right.
Just a question. I got to the